It's another Green Friday, guys. Another Green Friday, 23,500. And you know, the thing that I'm most excited about, and there's a lot to be excited about that we're going to talk about in the show, but the thing that I'm most excited about on the show is the fact that we're now finally back over the 200-week moving average. And if we close over this 200-week moving average, that means that after 5 weeks of being under the 200-week moving average, we're back. And we're back in trend. We're back in the longest Bitcoin trend that we've ever seen. So that's something to be excited about. But there's also something else to be excited about. We got the biggest announcement that we ever got from Ethereum, I think, yesterday. And now we pretty much know why the price of Ethereum went up. Well, let's see. Price of Ethereum went up from the bottom. 83%. We now know why that happened. That is because Vitalik made some big announcements at ETH Paris yesterday, and we're going to talk about all those big announcements. And that will probably give you guys a whole lot of perspective as to why Ethereum and Matic went up so much. So today's Friday. It's Banter Friday. It's our normal Banter Friday. There's going to be a huge, huge, huge banter. And let me tell you, I've been sitting here in the waiting room and speaking to our guests, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun here today. So let's get out of bed. Let's do this, man. So we're not allowed to do the get out of bed bitch go song anymore, because everyone says that it's a bear market and there's no more get out of bed bitch song. Finished. So if you were expecting it, it's going to be back, but it's only going to be back in the raging bull market. Fred vetoed it. So that's why there's no more get out of bed, bitch, go. All right, guys, it's Friday. We've got a lot to talk about. It's one of our biggest Friday banters ever. We've got three amazing friends. We've got two friends that have been here before. We've got one guy who's definitely a billionaire. You'll tell me at the end of the show which one of them is the billionaire. And then we've got one new friend joining the show today. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We've got a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about whether or not we've seen the bottom and whether this is just a bear rally or whether there's a lot more to come. We're going to talk about Ethereum. We're going to talk about Solana. We're going to talk about Coinbase employees being arrested for insider trading. And we're going to talk about Coinbase's response. We're also going to talk about Three Arrows Capital. For the first time after 5 weeks of not saying anything, they finally come out and broken the silence. And let me tell you, there's a lot of juice in what they spoke about. So it's going to be a big show. Remember, it is Friday. And our Friday banters are actually brought to you by NordVPN. They're the sponsor. They make this all possible. If you don't have a VPN and you are in crypto, you should have a VPN. You know that. You know that you should have a VPN for lots of reasons. One is a VPN basically marks your IP address. And if you're trading in crypto, you don't want to be revealing your IP address. If you reveal your IP address, you reveal your location. And you reveal your location to exchanges, to hackers, to dApps, to apps. And generally, you want to try and remain pretty anonymous. It just keeps you safer. And if you do want to sign up for NordVPN, there is a referral link below. Remember, there are the show sponsors. It costs about $3 a month. And one thing you will realize, so if you just click here and you say, so first of all, you can try it for 30 days risk-free. But if you do click grab the deal, you'll see that there are deals starting for as low as $3 a month to protect your crypto portfolio, and you can cancel it anytime, and you can get a refund if you're unhappy. And again, I want to remind you that every single sponsor that we have on the show is here for two reasons. The first reason is because that is, we use the product ourselves. Whether it's an exchange, whether it's a sponsor, we use the product ourselves. We use VPN, NordVPN ourselves when we're trading, when we're doing it. Also, because they bring great value to you guys as Crypto Banter, as a community. And NordVPN is exactly that. Not only do they bring you the show, but they do protect your crypto. So that is it from our sponsors. Let's get the show on the road. I know you guys always want to start. First of all, let's welcome our friends, our guests that have been here before. Vinny, welcome back, my friend, in the basement of his house, in the Fortnite, in the gym / Fortnite, what's it called? Dungeon.
The Fortnite cave, yeah.
You're in the dungeon. Then we've got Haseeb. Haseeb, welcome back, my friend.
Good to see you.
I see you, but I don't hear you. There we go. You're back.
Can you hear me now?
We can. Now we got you. All right. And now we've got someone that Haseeb says is, how did you describe it? You described him as the counter trade to everything that you do. So basically,
he is my arch enemy. That's right.
Okay. So we've got Avishal Gaj, and he is from Electric Capital. Is that right, Avishal?
That is correct.
All right, so just
I'm here to disagree with everything Haseeb says. That's the only reason I do podcasts now.
All right, so just before, because you are new to the family, and first of all, welcome to the family. We love having you here. Banter fam, just remember that if you like our guests, just smash a like, give them some appreciation. We're all here. We're all here to learn. And I think that these are three of the best in the industry. Abhishal, because you're new, just what is Electric Capital? Who are you? How did you get here? And why do you hate Asif so much?
So my background mostly as an entrepreneur. I started and sold two companies. It's like I went to Facebook, and then I was on the product team there for many years, and then left in 2016 to go full-time on crypto, and formalized all the investing I was doing in 2018 with my co-founder, Curtis, into Electric Capital. We do mostly seed and Series A, early stage venture investing. We're long hold. We don't trade. We don't go short. You know, pretty straightforward stuff. Mostly do kind of like $1 to $10 million checks, but we'll kind of scale up beyond that. And our most recent fundraise we just announced a couple months ago was $1 billion. And so we're sitting on a lot of capital to help companies and founders.
Well, hold on one second. Just slow down. You went a bit quickly there. Did you just raise $1 billion?
Yeah, we did. It's a lot of money.
So you're sitting at the, I don't know if it's the bottom of the bear market, because you're going to tell me that in a couple of seconds. But are you saying that you're sitting after a 70% unwind in the crypto market, you're sitting on $1 billion in cash to invest?
We don't have $1 billion in cash because we've been investing it, but we have a lot of cash to invest.
All right, so you do know I'm going to put you on the spot in a few minutes and ask you exactly what you've been investing in and why. But before we get there, let's quickly look at the markets, where we're at. So just quickly, I mean, I think everybody knows this, because anyone who doesn't know this probably shouldn't be in crypto, but we are now 23,500. Bitcoin has gone up from the 18,000 or wherever it was. Ethereum has had a massive, massive, massive recovery. It's up 76%. Ironically, 1 week before Vitalik's announcements, Ethereum goes up 70% in the week leading up to Vitalik's announcements. Matic is up, I think it's up almost 200%. Let's just have a look here. Matic is up right now 179% from its lows. What do you guys think of this bounce? There's some people in crypto that are calling this a relief rally. There's some people that say, you know what, the worst is over. The deleveraging has happened. All the pieces that would have fallen or could have fallen have already fallen. We now know the extent of the damage, and it's time to start rebuilding. Crypto was completely, completely, completely oversold because of all this unleveraging. And now it's time to get back to business and get back into the real markets. What do you guys think? Vinny, let's start with you, because you've been here. You always call this right. Vinny, I think you're muted.
You are muted, man.
Hey, thanks. I wouldn't say I'm always right, but I think that we've seen a couple of things. It's a confluence of events that have happened that deleveraged crypto. One is there was just a lot of froth in the market. Let's just be honest. Like last year, in the past 2 years, it's been a bit crazy, silly valuations, vaporware raising, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the narrative's kind of lost steam, and we didn't have enough, you just need time to build software. You don't just like put up a deck and the next day everything's built. There's a lot of like infrastructure that has to happen and be built. Also, there's just a lot of scams as well. And people were losing money left, right, and center because they were just getting FOMO and everything. So the industry itself got overheated. And that's a separate sort of contained event or series of events. Then the second part is macro, right? The macro conditions changed dramatically, and there was like an amplification. Macro just basically changed, 180 degree U-turn, and crypto was overheated, and so those two led to basically a massive deleveraging in crypto. Now, I think, I personally think the bottom's in crypto. I think we hit the 17K was the bottom. I think it was a pretty strong wick down from the 20K base. It's kind of like a trampoline. You hit it and it bounced all the way down, but there's this like level that didn't break the trampoline, the floor of 20K. And so I think we're on our way up, but I think it's a slower rise we can expect right now, because it's going to rise independently of macro. And I think that some of the macro conditions are all priced into crypto and into the broader market. You'd have to have a severe breakdown. I actually think there's some convexity in macro and crypto right now. The more macro breaks down, the more crypto actually may look more attractive, just because of what's happening with governments in the world and you know, the dollar euro, the dollar yen, etc. So I think we're at a point where, and you know, I I've gone long.
How much of this is macro, Vinny? How much of this is macro and how much of this is crypto? Like, yes, the NASDAQ
all of the deleveraging, including all the Celsius and all that stuff, was triggered by a macro downturn, but it was accelerated because the underlying fundamentals in crypto were effectively, it was just too frothy. It was too broken. And I think we're just busy rebuilding now. So I think if we expect, look, I personally have a target of 50K for Bitcoin by the end of this year, because I think that the macro conditions continue to deteriorate. And I think that that money has to flow somewhere. And if money can't flow into fiat and some of the other currencies, it either flows into US dollars, which has its own set of problems, or it flows into crypto and Bitcoin in particular. And I'm obviously very on Solana, but Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Solana will be my picks for where the money goes.
Okay, you're running ahead of the game. Haseeb, what do you think? Is this a crypto recovery?
Well, so Vinny, I agree directly with most of what you said about like why all this is happening. But I disagree that you can explain much of what's going on by crypto is too frothy, right? If the problem was froth, then you would see a lot more dispersion in the stuff that's bullshit and the stuff that's real. And we mostly have not seen that, right? There should be a lot of things that are going to zero or near zero. But instead, it's kind of a broad-based recovery. Like everything is coming back. And it's not as though NFTs drew down much more than, you know, high-quality layer ones. It's not as though, okay, suddenly things like, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but really low-quality layer ones that have no business being valued in the billions of dollars,
it's not liquidity,
you know, drew down to zero. It was Bitcoin ETH. Everything kind of drew down the same direction.
Sure.
Which feels to me like, to your point, it was deleveraging. But if it's about quality, if it's about like, okay, there's too many scams, there's too much garbage in the ecosystem, what you'd see is massive dispersion. People suddenly realizing, okay, this stuff is real and this stuff is not. And we're not there yet. There will eventually come a time when that happens, but it hasn't happened yet.
I don't think we ever get there. I mean, I've been in crypto for a decade, and most of the shit still survives. Nothing goes to zero in crypto easily.
To be clear, I agree. But I agree with that. I think it happens very slowly over a very long period of time.
Very slowly. And there's two things you need to keep in mind. Okay, one is the Bitcoin and Ethereum pair dominance of total crypto market cap. And then you can add a few others on top there. It's pretty high. It's like 90-something% between the major ones, right? So you've got 10% like dispersed around the rest of all the crap out there, 20,000 coins. Secondly, none of those coins have any liquidity. I mean, you can't actually sell. Yes, there's some bots and some perceived book. You know, the books are very thin. You try and dump like, you know, 100K and you're going to crash most things. So the money isn't actually there. You think it's there, but it's not there. The prices are bogus. So when I look at like as a percentage of total market cap, I'm not convinced that I think the dispersion, like it's kind of there, but it's fake, right? It's kind of there, but it's fake. And so because nothing goes to zero in crypto, there's always a bid and an offer, and there's always someone playing around with the prices and pumping and dumping. You just got to accept that it's going to sit there in the single digit percentage of total market cap, and it doesn't go to zero.
Haseeb, if I understand you correctly, are you saying that there could still be another, I'm not going to call it capitulation, but another leg down, and that is the cleanse? So you're saying that we maybe haven't cleansed enough? I mean,
that's not what I'm saying. I don't want to speculate on whether or not this will happen or when it will happen, because I honestly have no idea. But I'm saying that I think there's a lot of stuff in this market that is still going to go to near zero over time. But in what we saw was a broad-based indiscriminate sell-off, right? Deleveraging means that you run for cash. Everybody is selling whatever they have. So that is the opposite of, okay, we realized this stuff was too expensive and this stuff was real, and so that's why we're rotating out of the fake stuff into the real stuff, right? That has not happened. That is not a good description of what's happened. So when you see some of the things that are rebounding, some really low-quality stuff is rebounding beautifully, because that's just what happens when, you know, animal spirits are back and people realize like, hey, there's some narratives again, there's some life in the market. And people feel like the most forced selling is over. I think that's what most people are internalizing at this point, is that, hey, the deleveraging spirals, the forced liquidations, all that stuff seems to be done. Credit is super tight. There's very little money in crypto right now. That's why, you know, to Vinny's point, there's low liquidity on everything. It's not just the altcoins. Even Bitcoin and Ether are super low liquidity right now, because they're just, you know, when all the lenders got screwed after Three Arrows blew up, there's just much less money supply in crypto. So the market makers aren't keeping things liquid. Everything is super volatile. And that means volatile to the upside and to the downside. So I would expect a lot of volatility in both directions for the foreseeable future.
Avishal, welcome for your first your opening remarks. I mean, I think a good question was, you know, what do you think? Is this, has everything been flushed out? Are we now back to normal, back to business as usual?
Yeah, I'm with the same on this. I think what you saw was a lot of forced selling, and I think, you know, the kind of signals that we look at, and I say I don't know what the prices are going to do. It's not financial advice. You know, nobody really knows. And we tend to take a 10-year perspective on this, like, you know, 10 years from now, what's real and what's not. And the high quality stuff is going to be around 10 years from now. Who knows what it's worth? But, you know, the things that have real utility will still be here. But yeah, the signals I look at, in addition to kind of what Hasib is saying, is, you know, it has been very indiscriminate. You haven't seen that separation. And when you look at the true meme coins, you know, they're still around and they're still doing well. And, you know, when you look at, I look at things like, you know, in the top 10 or top 20, how many of those things are stable coins? Because that really tells you that people have moved back to cash and are sort of sitting in cash. Or, you know, I look at qualitative signals like, how many people want to talk to me? And, you know, if my high school friends are still texting me to talk about crypto, then, like, we haven't bottomed yet. You know, like, we're just not, I haven't seen that true blood in the streets. People think this thing is dead. Like, you know, when everybody here feels like they made a terrible career decision, I'm like, why did we choose to do this? That's the point. I feel like you've actually sort of, you know, you can start to say, okay, maybe things have hit bottom. And it just doesn't, to me, feel like we're there yet. It's just not, I don't know. Maybe either I'm dead inside, you know, and I can't feel pain anymore because I've been through this, or we just haven't experienced enough pain. And I'm inclined to think that we just haven't experienced enough pain yet.
So I'm so glad you said that, because I tweeted something just a little bit before the show. Let me try and find it quickly. So I tweeted something just before the show, and I said, you know what, if you're underwater now, you're actually underwater with 70% of other people in crypto, because about 70% of all people that have entered crypto are actually underwater now. So it's like, you know, if you're underwater now, you're actually part of the 70% that got in later. And the people that are not underwater are not underwater because they've been here for a long period of time. And being here for a long period of time doesn't only mean that they managed to buy cheap, but it also means that they were being here for long enough to go through multiple bull market and bear markets. And I think what we learn in a bull market and a bear market is we all made the same mistakes in the bull market. We all got carried by momentum. We all bought hype. We all invested in scam ICOs. We all gave our keys to someone. We all invested in fake Bitcoin mining scams. I think we've all seen that. And I think that the toughest part is actually to stay in the market for the time that you get bored and become dead inside, which I think is what Avishal called. It's like, I think it's the time. It's not the drop in prices that tests your conviction. It's the time. It's the time multiplied by the drop in prices, where your friends don't want to talk about crypto. And what I said to our team here is, I said, you know, like, you know, if you're worried about views going down on YouTube, or you're worried about engagement going down, well, just go and ask your friends if they still watch crypto shows. And I don't know about you guys, but not many people really care about crypto anymore. And that reminds me very much of where we were in 2018. The only problem is that in 2018, we still had about another year before we got a DeFi summer. And that DeFi summer created a whole lot of fake money, because everyone got tokens for liquidity mining, created a whole lot of fake money. And that spurred a bull market, because people started to reinvest those fake profits, and that just started to over-leverage a system. And so I think, going back to Avishal's point, I think we may have a long time, but I'm not sure that in that long time prices will go down much lower, because I think we had the forced selling, and the forced selling drove the prices down. But that doesn't mean, I think the next test is not how low we can go, but how long you can last at those levels. And specifically, how long can you last and still keep your conviction, if you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, I think who knows what prices will do. And in the grand scheme of things, if this industry is going to become what we all hope, with real utility and 2 billion people using this stuff, if all those things are going to come to pass, you know, the price movements today are going to be small relative to where, you know, where this thing can be. And so I think that the question you're asking is exactly the right one, is like, what is going to get users to come back? What is going to get developers to keep coming in? How do we create real utility? And kind of what are those catalysts over the next 6, 12, 18 months that actually bring people in, irrespective of what the price is?
So you speak about users.
Well, I was going to jump in. If you look at the fundamentals in crypto, right? So one of the things that to differentiate this downturn from, you know, 2018, right, which is when the ICO bubble popped. When the ICO bubble popped, the first thing, of course, nothing else was happening in the world, right? There was no war in, you know, Eastern Europe. There was no, you know, macro contagion going on. And what we saw when the 2018 bubble popped was that metrics basically nosedived straight into the toilet. Like nothing was happening anymore. There was no on-chain activity. Fees went to zero. Like everything just got dried up all at once. And when you look today, you get a very different picture of what this downturn looks like in terms of fundamentals, right? So if you look at active addresses on Ethereum, they're down about 20%. If you look at, you know, DEX volume, right? DEX volume is down around 25%, something like that. If you look at something like, you know, if you look at NFT volume, right? NFT trading volume, obviously in dollar terms, it's down massively because NFTs are down massively. But if you look in Ether terms, because remember, NFTs are all priced in Ether, or I mean, the Ethereum-based ones, not ones on Solana, they're priced in Ether. So as Ether goes down, their prices go down. And, you know, there's also a big wealth effect, right? The people who own NFTs, they own a bunch of Ether. So when Ether goes down, they're poorer. But the trading volume in Ether terms is down about 25%. It's not down 70%. It's not down 80%. It's down a lot less than what you're seeing in the prices, which tells you most of what's happening is macro. Most of what's happening is this broader thing that's been happening to a bunch of growth assets, not just crypto. And so the fundamentals actually look pretty healthy to me. So that's one of the reasons why I don't feel, you know, Avichal's view that is almost puritanical. They're like, look, we have to suffer for our sins. And then eventually, you know, once we've cleansed ourselves, then we can go into the next bull market. I think it's an appealing intuitive view. But in reality, like the honest answer is that there are a lot of people who are buying every one of these dips because a lot of people were just like, look, I thought it was crazy 3 months ago, but nobody who I'm talking to today, and here's the big difference between last bear market, nobody who I'm talking to today thinks crypto's over. Nobody thinks that it's done. Nobody thinks that it's dead. Nobody thinks that it's going away. Nobody thinks that in 5 years, Bitcoin will be gone, Ethereum will be gone, all this stuff was just a flash of the pan. They might think that about Axie Infinity. They might think that about NFTs. They don't think about crypto.
I want to show you one chart, and I want to talk about a second chart. So the first chart is the one I'm going to talk about, and that is the volume of Uniswap versus Coinbase. And right now, the volume of Uniswap versus Coinbase is almost 50%, 50-50. So they're doing equal ratio of volume. And to me, that shows that we're getting amazing adoption, which we never had, as you say, in 2017, 2018. We had zero adoption. We didn't have NFTs. People weren't using DEXs. So that was the first thing. Second chart, which I saw, which is, to me, this chart is mind-blowing. To me, this is the most mind-blowing chart in the whole world. I can't explain this chart. I wish I could. It is this chart over here, which is the Bitcoin addresses with less than 0.1 Bitcoin. And generally, what you can see is that these addresses usually rise when the market is rising and fall when the market is falling. So if you look historically, every time the market has gone up, the small fish have come in and bought the hype. For the first time, though, what we see now is that the market's come down and the growth of that chart is actually starting to be exponential. Okay, can someone walk me through what's actually going on here? I mean, has retail been sitting on the side and going, you know, when Bitcoin dips, I'm going to go and buy this dip. And this time they're actually doing it? Like, what's going on there? That doesn't make sense to me.
So if you look at the inflection point where this started moving up, it's around about the time of the Ukraine war. So I spent a lot of time in macro. My thesis is that people around the world in close to the war or feeling a little unsettled, especially small guys, are saying, hey, listen, let's put a little bit of money into Bitcoin and let's buy a little bit of Bitcoin. And so you have all the, you know, the smaller buyers coming in, people trying to get money out of the country, people fleeing Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. And if I speak to friends in South Africa or around the world, people are, like, a lot of people are buying small amounts of Bitcoin just in case. It's like, you know, Chamath called it insurance for smarts, you know, years ago. Kind of the same thing. Like, let's just own a bit of Bitcoin to get out. That's my take on it. And I think that the macro picture is deteriorating at a rate that faster than most people appreciate right now. The euro, the yen, I think that the Fed is going to have to step up and start buying euro bonds and you know, yen bonds and that sort of thing. Like, basically printing, doing QE for those countries. ECB just raised rates. I think everyone just like this is a very, very difficult situation. I don't think anyone has the answers, and I think we're going to see the second half of the year become pretty cataclysmic globally. I think you're going to see some states fail.
Why all of a sudden are the masses, the retail investor who usually hype into peaks, all of a sudden in the biggest trough, they're buying the most aggressively?
What was that, Vinny?
I said their currencies are being devalued against the dollar right now. And I think that, you know, people who have even a little bit of money are just saying, look, can I just put something into something which I, if our currency fails, you know, we have Bitcoin. That's the narrative, guys. Like, I'm not a Bitcoin maxi. I'm not anymore anyway. Not for 5 years.
He's a reformed. He's a reformed. Okay, that's great.
Bitcoin maxi in 2017.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
But, look,
that's the narrative. That's the narrative that people believe, right?
Sure. I mean, look, my honest answer is that I have no idea. I think that charts like this are black magic to try to, you know, we sort of reverse craft a narrative onto stats that pop out. The reality is that it's not people who are buying 0.1 Bitcoin who are moving the market, right? I mean, it kind of helps with the story, but the reality is that most of the marginal demand for Bitcoin that's changing the price is big institutional holders. That's part of the reason also why the correlation with the NASDAQ is so high. Like, the correlation with the NASDAQ is not because people are buying 0.1 Bitcoin when the NASDAQ goes down, right? Or it goes up or whatever. Like, the people who are buying the 0.1 Bitcoin, they are not a material part of the market. At this point, almost all of the flows are institutional that are determining the demand for Bitcoin and Ether. And I don't think you can divine really what's going to happen by looking at a chart like that.
I agree, well, but I'm trying to give Ryan some explanation as to why I think it's rising.
I agree with that. I think that's a very plausible
story. I agree with the narrative. And I think that the other thing to think about with some of the on-chain metrics is, you know, at some point the data will stop being, even if historically certain things were true. I think the question you always have to ask is the stuff that's actually happening from a fund flows perspective, to Haseeb's point, like the people that are buying and selling this stuff, actually getting reflected back on chain? Right? Is it the case? Like, I think Vinny's narrative is exactly right. I think a lot of people around the world are realizing that their local currencies, you know, have some big challenges. But will those people, when they buy Bitcoin, actually move it off the exchange into a wallet? Will they actually do that with, you know, small dollar amounts? I think there's like some open questions there about how users will actually behave and whether those things will get reflected on chain, which makes it really hard to Haseeb's point, I think, to divide whether or not there's any predictive power in some of these charts. I worry that even if they were predictive in the past, that like the market regime has really changed over the last 3 to 5 years as institutions have come in, and some of those correlations just won't work anymore.
Even 6 months, I would argue, or even 6 months, I'd say like, you know, the Ukraine invasion and the macro deterioration in the past 6 to 9 months has changed everything. Like, charts are just backward looking. They're not going to tell you what's going to go on going forward. I mean, there's some similarities, sure, in buying patterns and whatever else and the TA side of things, but the macro overrides everything.
Yeah, I will say, I hope it's true. I really wish Vinny's narrative is true, because I think it's, you know, a lot of people would benefit from not having so much. I mean, like, anybody in Ukraine right now, you know, we have people on our team, companies that we've invested in, where the founders and CEOs literally were able to get their families out of Ukraine because they had ETH, and they could take some Bitcoin and ETH and pay people to smuggle their family across the border.
Yep.
Like, I think the world, like, I totally agree with Vinny's narrative. I think the world over the last 6 to 12 months woke up to the idea that maybe non-sovereign currencies are valuable and have real utility.
Yeah,
I must say, we've got some community members who told us that they're Ukrainian and they survived just because they had ledgers with Bitcoin. And I think that's the narrative that's going to go. You spoke about macro. Now, I know that macro is a futile thing to speak about, but maybe we should speak about it just for a couple of minutes, because I do want to speak about crypto and alts and Ethereum and whatever else. The narrative that's been driving macro for the last couple of months, since November, let's say, I mean, the narrative that's been driving, you can say that the narrative that's been driving this chart all the way from here, which is November, all the way down to where we are today, has been an inflation narrative. Inflation, inflation, inflation. If we get inflation, the Fed's going to be aggressive. We got inflation of 9.1%. But now commodity prices have come down. A lot of companies are not hiring anymore, or some of them are even retrenching or firing. So we're getting a slowdown in jobs. We're getting inflation, which should come down quite a bit, because if you look at commodities prices, gas prices, even rentals in the US are starting to come down for the first time in a long time. Do you think that given the fact that we have a Fed meeting now, the following day we have the GDP numbers, and I think GDP numbers may just be negative, and that will just put the US into recession, if you want to use that definition of a recession, so to speak. Do you think that, given the fact that there's in August no FOMC meeting, someone's echoing in my ear, I don't know if it's, do you think that in September we'll get a lower inflation and that will give the Fed a license to go easier on everything?
Vinny, you're the macro guy. I want to hear what you say.
I want to say I think inflation's peaked, but I also think that we could get surprised and it goes up even more. The reality is that the inflation numbers are not like. Raising rates is not solving the inflation problem. We know this. It's the externalities. But the price of oil has come down. I think there may be some lag in the system, and that's why we see an inflation spike. And also the methodologies to calculate inflation aren't exactly perfect. So we may see some of that play through, and we may see another mini wick up. But I think we're at the tail end of the inflationary pressures that from the world that exists today right now. I think the macro deterioration in foreign currency, balance of trade payments, all those other things are going to come into play as well. The Fed has to pivot at some point. They cannot keep going up at this point. I think it's going to, above 3.8% or above 4%, you're going to basically have a sovereign debt crisis in the world. I mean, we are paying, or the world is basically sitting at 350% of debt to GDP ratio right now. 350%, okay? At 4%, at 4% rates. By the way, let me point this out. The world is short dollars right now. Okay, there's a lot of dollar-denominated debt in the world without the underlying dollars backing it. So these countries are having to pay this debt by printing more of their currency, okay? And then that creates more inflation as well. And weaker currencies. This is a very, very complex problem right now, and I don't think that the Fed has the wherewithal to solve it in advance. I think they're going to have to deal with it blow by blow as it comes. And I think that that's what they're dealing with every single month. I don't think they can. I don't think they're able to look forward even 2 or 3 months at this point.
Vishal, what do you think?
So I'm not a macro guy. It's hard for me to understand what's going to happen. To Vinny's point, this stuff is just so interconnected. The thing that I think about kind of are two or three things maybe adjacent to what Vinny's saying. So one, I think there's a human element to this, which is if you're Jerome Powell, if you're the Fed. What do you want your legacy to be? And I think, and your legacy in 2020 was going to be, we were the people that saved the world from COVID. Like the whole thing was going to fall apart and we bailed everybody out and we fixed it and we're great. And the legacy now may actually be, we had 10% inflation. We kind of effed it up. And I think in that context, I have to imagine that the greater likelihood is that they overcorrect in order to sort of, from the human element, I think they're more likely to want to try to preserve the legacy just in case, inflation does run away from us. One, two, I think to the inflation stuff and the interest rate stuff, it's challenging because the Fed can only really crush demand, right? They can't really solve the supply side stuff. Like a lot of this inflation is because of supply chain and sort of commodity prices and so on. So you're going to crush demand. And if you look at a lot of the really smart macro people, like if you look at the LaFonts who run Coatue, you look at Stan Druckenmiller, you look at, these people who have been around for multiple economic cycles and are on the macro side, many of them think that it's really the third leg down in the stock market is going to be earnings. Because once you hit a recession, earnings come down because GDP slows down. And when you have a PE compression, then earnings come down. And that's like the future of the stock market. So a lot of these guys are sitting on a lot of cash. Now, of course, if everybody's on the same side of the trade, the market will do something else. So, there's that element to think about is if all the smart money is on one side of it, what actually happens? Maybe something else, which is why I think this is so unpredictable. But I think it is interesting to think that a lot of these people think that we haven't really hit that third leg of earnings compression on a recession. And then for us, all of us here, I think the thought is, well, what does that ultimately do to crypto, right? If that's what people think is happening with inflation and interest rates in the stock market, what does that mean for crypto? And I don't know the answer to that, but fortunately for us, I kind of think about three eyes right now. I think about inflation. Obviously, that has a big impact on what happens with currency prices and so on. There's interest rates, which I think the Fed is trying to sort out. But the third eye here is innovation, which is ultimately on a 10-year time horizon, that third eye matters more than the first two, right? Like if we can't innovate our way to more productivity and can't innovate our way to more utility at a rate of greater than 3%, which is the inflation rate, we're kind of fucked anyway, right? Like if society can't innovate at faster than 3%, we're kind of screwed. So kind of the position I take is over the next 12 to 24 months, inflation and interest rates, I have no idea. But over the next 7 to 10 years, I'm very, very long innovation. And that's like to me the safest trade to make is just bet on innovation, because that will be the dominant eye over those three over the next decade. Anyway, that was a long rant. I have no idea what happens over the next 2 years, but I'm taking the easy way out, which is I'm pretty sure in 7 years we're all better off.
So you just adopt a much longer time horizon. You don't look at the ups and downs of now. You've got a 10-year view. So you don't really care about what inflation does now, because you're just investing.
I do care in so much as, I mean, it has real world impact. That's a thing. You know, it's like these things that at the end of the day, like, you know, everybody here will be fine. I think the kind of things I worry about are like, I grew up in Kentucky and Ohio in the middle of the country. And it's like, you know, it's like auto workers. It's people that work retail. It's people that join the army and then they come back. And those people those are the people I worry about, because like a couple of percent inflation, when you have no margin for error and you have no savings and you have no assets, that's the stuff I really worry about. So, you know, I think crypto will be fine. I think innovation will be fine. I think technology will be fine. I actually worry that the downstream effects of this stuff are really on society and social cohesion. And like, what happens, you know, what happens to the 50% of people who have $0 in the bank account? Right. Listen, like that's what I actually worry about more than anything.
I mean, I live in Africa. You grew up in Kentucky. We live in Africa. You know, the top 3% of the population have everything and the rest have pretty much nothing. So we know exactly what that's about.
Yeah.
I see, literally in 1 minute, give us your view about the three eyes.
The three eyes. Jeez. Look, I have the fortunate position of not being a trader, so I don't have to take a view on these things. I agree with Avichal that look, at some point rates will come back down. I agree with Vinny that part of the reason why is that eventually the U.S. government will go bankrupt along with every other government if rates are sustained at a high level, because we just have so much debt burden that we can't service that debt if rates are high. So rates have to be low, and when rates come back down, probably, you know, they're going to put the juice bowl, the punch bowl back out, and the party's going to be back on. So I don't know how long it's going to take. Is it going to take a year? Is it going to take 2 years? Is it going to take 3 years? I don't know. But eventually, you know, governments will go bankrupt, so rates will come down. That's the first order thing. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So no, I want to give our sponsors some love, because they give us love by sponsoring the show, making it so possible. And then when we come back, I want to speak about Ethereum. And I want to get into to altcoins and investments. Basically, I want a degen. So let's just give our sponsors some love and we'll pick it up from there.
This Big Friday banter is brought to you by NordVPN. NordVPN is a security product that every crypto trader must have as part of their essential tools. For crypto traders, NordVPN encrypts your personal data, hides your IP address, and enables you to access crypto trading platforms from any geographical location, giving you the freedom to buy and sell crypto completely anonymously. It also protects you from hackers and phishing attacks. NordVPN is super easy to use, offers security for up to 6 devices, and with servers in over 60 countries, is the fastest VPN out there. The promotional link below gives you up to 61% discount and a 30-day money-back guarantee on your purchase.
All right, we're back. Give some love to NordVPN. There's a referral link below. Protect yourself, protect your crypto. That's what we use. All right, let's... I'm getting a bit of an echo where it's coming from. Maybe it's coming from Vinny. 1, 2, 1, 2. All right.
I was on mute, so it wasn't me.
All right. So let's pivot this discussion to ETH. And what Vitalik said yesterday, which I think was pretty cool. I'm going to play some snippets of it, which I think are very cool. I'm going to start off with this one.
The end of which, Ethereum will be a far more scalable system. Ethereum today can process about 15 to 20 transactions a second. This Ethereum, including the rollups, including the sharding, at least according to the math, it's going to be able to process 100,000 transactions a second. And you know, hopefully there's going to be a lot of other benefits that come at the same time, right? The Verge, stateless clients, so you will be able to verify Ethereum blocks and even be a validator without having hundreds of gigabytes.
So we've got a date or a proposed date or a range of dates for the merge, which is somewhere around September the 12th, the 19th, depending on exactly when it happens. That sent the ETH price up. You've now got Vitalik coming out and he broke down the ETH merge into 4 different parts, the merge, the surge, the five different parts. the Merge, the Surge, the Verge, the Purge, and the Splurge, which I think was classic. But he did say that the Merge, which is the part of the ETH upgrade, which goes from proof of work to proof of stake, is almost there. And he said this, which I think it's pretty interesting. He said that when that happens, even though we're not going to get the cheaper, faster 10,000 transactions, I want you guys to hear what he did say.
We're still this kind of this end goal, but you know, we're a bit further away from getting there. I'd say it's 50. Ethereum can go up to being 55% complete after the merge. We're getting close.
So he's saying that Ethereum will be 55% completed after the merge. And then he said that, I mean, he spoke about this, which I think was amazing. And I want to pick up this part of the discussion specifically. Let me quickly get it. 1840. He talks about the importance of
layer two. Optimize for like actually doing really amazing and impressive stuff. And layer two has been doing amazing and impressive stuff, right? Like there have been all of these ZK EVM announcements that we saw over the last couple of days. There's a lot of work that's being done, by both the Optimistic and the ZK teams. Optimism has added compression. Arbitrum has been kind of quietly progressing and just becoming more stable and adding features. Starknet has recently made.
So you spoke about all the different sidechains and layer two scaling solutions and whatever else. Are you guys more bullish on ETH now that there's a date, there is a TPS number, there is it just feels like it's real. I know we've all heard this before, but it just feels real. What do you think, Haseeb? I see you smiling.
Yeah, I think that this is, so first of all, I don't think we learned anything yesterday from Vitalik's speech. Like all this stuff was already public knowledge. Vitalik isn't even like super involved in the actual merge process. It's all being done by these client implementation teams. Like there's been test nets that have been doing this stuff for months now. And so I think it was about a week ago that we actually learned the tentative date, which was mid-September. But if you look at, none of these markets are very liquid, but if you look at prediction markets for when the merge is going to happen, at this point, it's like 90-something% that markets are pricing that it gets done before the end of the year, meaning that there's still a chance that it happens after the end of the year. And it could be October, it could be November. It's very, very likely that people will get spooked because something is just kind of like, oh, wait, what about this? What if this thing happens and they delay it another month? So I think one, it's very, very likely that the thing gets delayed just because things in Ethereum land get delayed. And so like anybody who hasn't learned this lesson already, I feel for you, but probably there's going to be at least some delay as opposed to them hitting the date perfectly. But second, I want to just remind people, because a lot of people forget this. When Ethereum first launched, right? So this is like 2014, 2015 time period, Vitalik wrote a blog post saying that the next step after Ethereum launch was to migrate to proof of stake, and he predicted it would happen by 2017. Okay, it is now 2022. It has been a really long time. Okay, so Vitalik now saying that he thinks ETH 2.0 is 55% complete. I remember when ETH 2.0 was supposed to be a bunch of shards that all do computation, and like there are a bunch of little Ethereums that all connect to each other. That's no longer even on the roadmap. They decided that that's not even worth doing because it's so hard and they're so slow at actually shipping software. So look, I feel excited about the merge. The merge is going to be awesome. It's going to do a lot for Ethereum and for the entire crypto world. But I just don't think we actually learned anything yesterday. I think people are just excited because there was good earnings. Like corporate earnings was good. NASDAQ went up and so crypto went up.
Reminds me of Lightning Network, right? It'll be ready in 18 months.
Perpetually. Yeah, exactly. I get very strong Lightning vibes every time people self-congratulate, because like this thing was supposed to happen a long time ago. I'm glad it's happening, but I just don't know where the fanfare is coming from.
Ryan, you're on mute.
Oh, Ryan, you're muted. We can't hear you. Still can't hear you, man.
There we go.
There you go.
Are you an ETH man? Are you an ETH fan? We don't know your views on ETH, so just maybe we know Vinny's a big Solana man. So I'm going to leave him for last. Are you a big ETH? Are you an ETH man? Are you an ETH fan?
You're talking to Avichal, yeah?
Yeah, are you talking to me? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love ETH. ETH is the reason I actually got into crypto ultimately. Because, you know, when we were doing our startup, we were mining a little bit of Bitcoin. This is back in 2010. And we just misunderstood it. We thought it was a way to pay for computational power. And so we ended up selling most of our Bitcoin in like 13, 14. And only when we saw Ethereum did we sort of say, oh, this is the thing that we thought Bitcoin was, which then, of course, prompted the question, well, what the hell is Bitcoin, which then forced us to understand currencies and non-sovereign money and all this kind of stuff. We, you know, we're scientists, we're computer scientists, we're engineers. We didn't really understand that stuff. So I've loved ETH from the very beginning. But everything Haseeb says, unfortunately, I agree with, which is, it's just been a long time, man. It's been years and years and years. And it's perpetually 3 to 6 months away. You know, it's been like 6 months away for 4 years. And so I kind of, you know, I hope it ships. I think it will ship, you know, soon. I don't know if it's by September, but I think it's very likely that it slips. And even when it does slip, I think, you know, I think people have to also remember it's a great milestone. I think it's a huge accomplishment to have an open source ecosystem like this. So this is not to discredit anybody who's working on this. I think it's a really, really, really hard thing to ship software, and it's like 10x harder to do it out in the open and do it with, you know, this many moving pieces. But I think that from like an infrastructure perspective, we also have to remember that pretty much every time you launch any new infrastructure at the infrastructure layer, the app layer is just going to soak it up, right? And so we're going to be back in the same situation that we're in very quickly, in my opinion. Like, I think we're going to be back in this, oh no, everything is bottlenecked and it's slow and it's, you know, gas fees are high. Like, I think we end up back there actually very quickly. And just think about your computer, right? Like, think about how much your computer is probably 10 million times faster between the RAM and multiple cores and CPU and all this stuff than it was 10 years ago. And think about how slow it is. It still feels slow, right? Just because like the app layer will just suck up the infrastructure and the available capacity. And so I think we're going to be having this conversation again in, you know, 12 months after this merge launches. We're going to be back in the same conversation of like, okay, everything is slow again, and how do we fix it? And then you take another 3 years.
Not just that. Avijit, I want to add to that is that back three, four years ago, right, when somebody would say we're going to be 100,000 TPS in like, you know, 1 year or whatever, yeah. People had a lot of credulity. They were like, oh, really? Oh man, I bet it totally could. You know, the next gen of blockchains is probably going to be so fast and so scalable.
Yeah.
What he means when he says that Ethereum is going to do 100,000 TPS is that if you launch a quadrillion rollups and fill up every single ounce of Ethereum block space with just rollups settling to layer one and nothing else happening on layer one, then you get a big number like 100,000. Okay. That is obviously not what's going to happen. You are not going to have every single square inch of block space filled with rollups. It's going to be a few rollups that a lot of people use, and those rollups are going to have high fees. And then most of the rest of it is going to be, you know, just people posting NFTs or whatever on layer one. And that, like, we were talking about Solana earlier with respect to Vinny. Solana's TPS and the TPS that Vitalik described are not the same kind of TPS. And in 2022, I think it's important that we hold that distinction in our minds.
So Solana TPS is non-rolled up TPS, and ETH TPS, as you're saying, is inclusive of all rollups in terms of ZK rollups, optimistic rollups, whatever else. And so you're saying that when Vitalik says 100,000 TPS, what he means is with all the infrastructure and all the L2s, maybe Ethereum will achieve something like that at full capacity. But if you think about Solana, we're talking about Solana, which is one, no rollups, vanilla, straight to the operating system. I want to ask you a question here. So when I listened to Vitalik yesterday, and I listened to him talk about layer twos, and I thought of all the progress that Matic has been making and all the noise they've been making, and they really are the layer two that's probably getting the most traction. What is the future for other EVM-compatible chains in a world where there is a ETH 2.0, there is a whole host of side chains, scaling solutions, roll-up solutions, etc.? What is the world for a Moonbeam or for an Avalanche or for anything that is EVM compatible, with the excuse of, you know, when I listened to that yesterday and putting everything that I heard in the last 2 weeks into perspective, I kind of thought to myself, really, do I need to be invested in Avalanche? Do I need to be invested in Moonbeam? Or, you know, maybe my bet should be something that's EVM compatible, which is probably Ethereum, Matic, plus, and then maybe going to Near and Solana when I'm looking for something that's not really EVM compatible.
I mean, I'll jump in here for a sec. Like, when it comes to scale and you know, scaling across like L1s and L2s, I mean, yes, you can get 100,000 TPS, you know, fine. But the composability gets broken at that point. This is, like, the transactions can't happen fast enough. And that's where Solana actually wins if everything's on one L1. You have instant transactions across the network, and the ecosystem that are building around Solana, the composability is the big issue here. You, like, I use you know, obviously use Polygon or Arbitrum. It's just too slow. You cannot, the transactions don't settle fast enough. Even the, and I'm not sure how, even with the rollups, like how are we going to get composability going across different, because you're going to have different L2s. How are they going to work with each other? And if you're basically fragmenting out the market of developers, you're going to have, you know, apps that don't really work well together. I mean, I haven't spent a ton of time in Ethereum, guys. I'm not a big Ethereum guy, but that's my understanding of it, is that like the composability problem isn't solved with even increasing the TPS.
Abhishek, what do you think? I mean, what do you think of the, you know, do we need to be invested in other EVM compatible blockchains just because they're EVM compatible?
A couple of thoughts. I think it's increasingly looking like, you know, EVM has a lot of developer traction, and you're just seeing the ecosystem there be really robust. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a winner-take-all market, though, right? I think most markets are not winner-take-all, and you generally get some sort of power law where even if the big winner is 60 or 70% of the market, there's a lot of space for other people. And so I think it's unlikely that we have only EVM. Like, I think you'll have these other tool chains and toolkits. You know, there are a lot of Rust developers in the world. There are a lot of C++ developers in the world and so on. There are a lot of JavaScript developers in the world. So I think there's going to be a lot of space for people to come in and build other things that are adjacent to EVM. Now, that being said, I think the challenge here, or one of the challenges here, is I suspect we're in this, like if you look at a lot of markets historically, they go through this sort of massive expansion period, and then they go through a consolidation period, and then a re-expansion period. So look at like social networking, right? In the mid-2000s, you had Hi5, Bebo, Orkut, MySpace. You know, you had like hundreds of regional social networks, and then and Facebook, and eventually Facebook kind of came in and won. And I think we're kind of in that period right now. I think we're in an expansionary period, and we're going to have to go through some sort of consolidation. And it's unclear what that consolidation is, you know, how that's going to play out right now. But I can't imagine a world like, you know, 5 years from now where we have so many disparate options. I think some of these network effects around tools and developers and liquidity and all this kind of stuff has yet to play out. And the thing I would call out there is the best technology doesn't necessarily win. And there are going to be a lot of other network effects here at play. And so that's what makes it so hard to predict actually what's going to go on. So yeah, maybe the L2s win, maybe Polygon wins because they have just amazing BD. Maybe you know, you get a much more heterogeneous network with Near and Solana bridging back to ETH. Like I think it's a nobody really knows at this point. But the two things I can say for sure are I don't think it's going to be winner take all. I think there's likely a lot of space for non-UVM stuff. And two, it's very unlikely that the best technology wins. It just historically, it's almost never the case. Actually, it's almost usually the case that an inferior technology with a better marketing plan wins. And so I think those two, I suspect both those things will hold here too.
So before I let Haseeb speak about this, views on your views specifically on Polkadot. So you have Polkadot, you have Moonbeam, which is the EVM. Haseeb, I saw that. So this is probably going to be a good question. Your views on Polkadot and, you know, this whole, you know, model of creating this chain that links all other chains, if you want to call it that, and having an EVM compatible chain, which is right now Moonbeam, but there are others, of course, that are building on it. Do you think that that's a horse in the race? Is that something that you're backing?
No. So I think Polkadot is basically a giant mess. Like Polkadot, so you described Polkadot originally as supposed to connect all the chains. Do you see Polkadot connecting all the chains? No. What is it connect? It's connecting its own child chains to each other, which, okay, how is that a problem to begin with? Now, to your point, okay, the primary thing happening on Polkadot today is Moonbeam, which is just another EVM. The whole point of Polkadot. I remember when Gavin Wood was talking this big game about how Polkadot was going to take over Ethereum. It was a better version of Ethereum. Ethereum got everything wrong. And what do they have? They have like a little baby EVM that has, you know, a small amount of traction, which is Moonbeam. And besides that, nothing else on Polkadot is working. Everything around Polkadot has been basically engineered to be this enormous pomp and circumstance, like these big auctions, like, oh, the first auction was won. Oh, we did this thing on Kasama. We did this thing. They don't even have cross-chain messaging yet within Polkadot, which is crazy because that's the primary point of Polkadot. So I just think that Polkadot has absolutely fumbled the ball. They have been way behind any of the promises that they've made about how they're going to innovate. And they're just, you know, being the first, and this is a good lesson for anybody who is thinking about what it takes to build a strong token. When Polkadot first launched their token, everybody was so excited. They're the first player to come into interoperability, right? It's so amazing. But they just had a token. They did not actually solve the interoperability problem. They were just the first to launch a token. Now you have people who are actually tackling the interoperability problem, like people like Layer Zero, people like Axelar, people like, you know, there's Multichain, there's all these guys who are actually trying to tackle the super hard problem of interoperability across multiple blockchains. And while you know, I don't know what the hell Polkadot's doing, but they haven't solved that problem. That problem is still huge. It's still outstanding. We still need solutions to it.
Vishal, what do you think? Polkadot?
Polkadot's tough. I mean, you know, we look at developer metrics in aggregate, and they do have developers building in that ecosystem. But yeah, the rate of stuff that's been shipped that's actually being used that has real traction, you know, I think doesn't map quite cleanly to that. The sort of adjacent ecosystem that I think is kind of interesting is the Cosmos ecosystem. And that ecosystem, it, you know, sort of similar-ish vision, right? This idea of like, there's almost this like world, one world view of everything goes, I think there's like three worldviews. There's this worldview of like ETH as a settlement layer for some definition of settlement layer with like a bunch of L2s on top that sort of write rollups back. I think there is a much more heterogeneous worldview, which is like you have Solana and Near and Ethereum, and you have bridges that move assets around, and you have sort of, you know, this specified, you know, ecosystems, and they sort of synchronize somehow. And I think there's this like third worldview, which is if we're going to have multiple app-specific chains and we need these things to all talk to each other, why don't we just standardize a bunch of stuff? Why don't we just have SDKs that make it really easy to build an app chain? Why don't we have SDKs that make it really easy to communicate? And that's kind of like roughly, I think, the Polkadot Cosmos worldview. But I think Cosmos has executed on this much, much, much better in terms of the actual utility of the thing. There's a whole set of questions around value capture with the Atom token, which are challenging. So not intended as an investment advice at all. But I think the Cosmos worldview, it's pretty fascinating to see. I mean, you look at like DYDX is moving over from Starknet, and they're going to build their own app chain. It's pretty remarkable.
I must say, I think I agree with you fully. I think that the Cosmos ecosystem is much, much, much more interesting than any of the ecosystems, actually, if you think about it. But the Cosmos, the Atom token, which is the token, doesn't capture any of the value of the amazing traction that the technology has captured. Anyway, listen, on that note, I want to just say that I feel cheated because you guys promised me you were going to disagree on everything. You pretty much agreed on everything.
I think it's a Vichel's fault. I was disagreeing with him. He disagreed with me.
But we didn't get to all the things that we disagreed.
I'll do a slight disagreement with Vichel. I think that, first of all, I think that what you see in most markets is that the two top players capture most of the value. So you get like, you know, Apple and Windows, and you get Android and iOS, and, you know, so on and so forth. You see this over time, Xbox, PlayStation, etc. I think the same is going to happen in crypto, where you're going to have the two leading players. So I'll say it's Ethereum and Solana. And then you'll have a bunch of contenders, challengers like Nintendo, etc., that capture smaller parts of the market. But most of the value is going to accrue to the top two, maybe three. And so let's say 90%, 95% of the value accrues there. And the others are all contenders. So they can always be disruption. They can always jump ahead. And the payoff backing one of those contenders is going to be really high, right? So if you back a number 5 or 7 or 10 chain, and it goes to number 3 spot, it could be a 20-to-1 payoff or whatever it is. So the market will price the tail in accordance with the sort of risk return that you see in the tail, knowing that number 1 is worth X, number 2 is worth Y, and number 3 is worth Z, and those three add up to 90-something%. That's my thesis on
it. Amazing. Let's leave it on that note. I did say to everyone, we're going to end it after an hour. We're very close to an hour. Listen, love you guys. You guys have been unbelievable. I love Fridays. I love the level of intellect. I love these discussions. I do have to have you on, all of you separately. And I keep saying that, but I just never find the time. But I'm going to actually get it done. So first of all, thank you guys. You're all a great part of the Banter fam. The value that you've given the fam, that you've given us, is absolutely amazing. Also to you guys, we are hosting a Twitter space. And if you guys can make it, it's on my Twitter, CryptoManner. And just join us for 10 minutes. There may be some questions from the audience. We do want to give the audience a chance to, like, you know, interact with you guys, because I've heard your views. So if you could just be around to answer a few questions. The space is on my Twitter. Kaylin, if you could just retweet that. She's our social media manager. If you could just retweet that, let's get everybody on. And thank you again. Thank you, guys. Thank you for everything. You guys are really an amazing part of the Banter fam. So thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Take care, guys.
We'll see them on Twitter spaces. To the Banter fam, listen, I've had a lot of fun. We are out of time. I promise you on Monday, we'll do some Bybit 10x the portfolios. I want to just thank our sponsors once again, NordVPN. Remember, if you don't have a VPN, you are really playing with fire. Go to the referral link below, click on NordVPN, get your VPN. It's going to cost you less than $3 a month to protect your crypto. I will see you guys again on Monday, or maybe I'll see you guys on the weekend if there's something happening on the weekend. Until then, have fun, trade well, my friends.